Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. All so that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. So just like you, he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
He was a dentist, a dad, and a man of faith.
Yes, he was Mormon.
But prosecutors say James Craig was also a cold-blooded killer, slowly poisoning his wife Angela with cyanide and eye drops, like you do, all while smiling at her bedside and carrying on an affair. This is a murder trial built on digital footprints, toxology, and one of the most bizarre post-crime cover-up attempts we've seen in years, including deep fake video attempts and jailhouse letters to his own daughter. Joining me is defense attorney, former prosecutor Eric Faddis, who's actually been inside the courtroom watching it all unfold. And we're going to break it down. The public mask, the murder method, the messy cover-up, and the battle strategies on both sides of the aisle. Eric, let's start with the public mask versus the very private murder that took place here in this case. He's obviously been charged with the murder. He was an ideal community figure, that dentist, that family man, that churchgoer. What are you seeing? What's been your first impressions in that courtroom as he walks into there every single day?
You know, the prosecution has really drawn a contrast between his public-facing image and what they say, the dark deeds were that he committed behind closed doors. He was this dentist. He would actually do lectures internationally. He was traveling. You know, he appeared to be a family man, had six children. But behind the scenes, at least according to the prosecution, he was taking concerted measures to kill his wife. He had an affair that was ongoing, to which he admits. There were also some financial troubles. So a lot messier, sort of just below the surface.
How is he, since we don't have cameras in there, is he in jail garb? Is he wearing a suit? What are they allowing him to do at this point?
Visual presentation and demeanor has been kind of surprising to me. So he's allowed to be in there with a suit on that the jurors don't know that he is, living just across the street in the jail. But inside the courtroom, Tony, he really has this confidence about him. Perhaps it's a misplaced confidence, but, he's sitting upright. He's smiling at the gallery. He is participating, conferring with his attorneys regularly. You know, he's not this sort of meek little mouse who's cowering in the corner at all.
Which is interesting. What were you expecting going into this? Especially, now that we know like all of these things that were going on from the jail, which we'll get into in a little bit. But what were you expecting when you walked in there?
You know, usually in, especially in a murder case, the defendant sometimes is scared, fearful, nervous, oftentimes kind of sheepish and unfamiliar with the legal terrain, and sort of, you know, looking overwhelmed and fearful. But that is just not the case with James Craig. Like I said, he's sitting upright. He is nodding his head to answers that he likes and shaking his head no to answers he doesn't like. He is very much engaged in the trial. And I think, you know, I got the impression he feels like he's somewhat untouchable.
What did you see in an opening statements from both? Let's start with the prosecution and what they kind of brought to the table. And then we'll break it all down a little bit further. But just in those opening statements, what was it like?
So the prosecution has a mountain of evidence and in many different forms. So they have the toxicology report that details what they say killed Angela Craig, that being the poisons. They also have alleged jailhouse letters and communications that James Craig made to try and cover up this whole mess. On top of that, they have a ton of texts from James Craig. So we, in a sense, have heard from him already in terms of his admissions to infidelity, what he was saying to Angela Craig. And then also they detailed a photograph of Angela Craig when she was clearly medically compromised that they say he sent to his mistress as his wife of and mother of his six children was dying.
That right there is that's one of those where it's like, this might be the nail in your coffin, that little text right there. It's I mean, it's like the Koberger picture in the morning after, where it's like, that selfie, it just seals it worse than everything you've done. Obviously, though, he's coming across, and it sounds like he looks pretty professional. Obviously, if you're an attorney, you're going to want your client to look as best as they can visually in front of that jurors. How did jurors naturally give the benefit of the doubt to someone with Craig's kind of background? You know, the stable, the family man, he's out giving lectures, got the religious ties that he's rocking and all that. I mean, it crumbles people's sense of safety and normalcy to think that that's the guy that went and, you know, slowly poisoned his wife to death until she went brain dead.
Yeah, you know, I think that is certainly the case here. He kind of has a leg up, I would say, just based on that background. And during the defense's opening statement, they talked about that he is, you know, devoutly religious, that he's a family man, was a quasi-successful dentist, depends on who you ask. But yeah, they really sort of painted a picture of him that was starkly contrasted with what the prosecution's opening said. And also, Tony, during defense's opening, they kind of went after Angela Craig, the alleged victim in this case, calling her manipulative and said there's going to be testimony to the effect that she was a manipulative person. We haven't yet seen that inside the courtroom.
How do you think that's going to go? I mean, to go to the dead person and say, well, she was manipulative. Yeah, he was slipping her Visine by the gallon. You know, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, you can be in an unhappy relationship. You can have a partner that's manipulative. But the way out isn't murdering them. That always seems like a weird defense to be bringing up, or even a point to bring up when the person is dead.
I'm not sure how it moves the ball for a defense because their likely defense is going to be that Angela Craig was suicidal and somehow did this to herself. Mm-hmm. But being manipulative isn't required to draw that conclusion. A jury could draw that without sort of going after her character in that way. And you always, when you do that, risk insulting the jury, offending them. You know, if this was in fact just a suicide by Angela Craig, you don't need to kind of pile on and make her look bad. And I don't think the jury's going to dig that.
I know that there are texts that they're supposedly going to be show that show betrayal and heartbreak, not necessarily suicidal ideation going on. But one could say if you're heartbroken and betrayed, you would naturally have that as well. Possibly, maybe, if you want to believe that over there, juror number five. But it's not always the case. And especially a way of dying like this. Is that the road you think that they're going to be going down? That this was a self-inflicted suicide by the cyanide that my husband happened to buy and get to his office and, you know, the extended release eye drops from Walgreens?
You know, Tony, I was talking about this with Carol McKinley. She's a reporter for the Denver Gazette and has done things nationally. And she brought up a really good point that if a person wants to commit suicide, usually you want it to be quick and as painless as you can do it. Mm-hmm. You don't want to draw it out over the course of weeks by sort of incrementally introducing poisons into your body such that you have to be hospitalized three different times until that final act is committed. And so I think that could be a hard sell for this jury.
In the setting... as well. I want to talk about that. And as far as how that will play to the jury and the fine line, I would imagine that the prosecutor is having to walk in this case because number one, you don't know where the jury is sitting on this guy. If you, they are looking at him as well, he's coming across as this affable family man. Maybe he's being wrongly prosecuted. And if you go at him too hard, that can fire back at you the wrong way. And then you also have the religious component of it as well. He was a Mormon. And for whatever reason, we can add this to our ungodly high list of Mormons committing crimes. I don't know why it's insanely higher than other groups of folks, but it is. You got that aspect, and it's being tried, you know, in an area where you have a fairly large community of that going on. Not saying there's anything wrong with it. All I'm saying is, you know, sometimes it makes it more difficult when you have members of your same religion on that jury because they, again, it's that acceptance thing, not wanting to believe that there's a world where someone else who was like this could actually be like that.
Totally, Tony. I think the prosecution has done a good job walking that line. I actually personally know the prosecutors very well. Ryan Brackley, who's the second in command at that office, is the lead prosecutor on the case. Mike Morrow is another prosecutor. I've done tons of trials with them. And the way that they've been approaching this is really in kind of a matter of fact and rather meticulous fashion. It's been pretty dispassionate. They're not, you know, going and saying, hey, he's a dirty, rotten SOB. They're kind of saying, hey, look, this is the evidence. These are the text messages, and allowing the jury to sort of draw whatever conclusions they're going to draw about him. So I think they've been doing a good job of not kind of overstepping that boundary and possibly hurting their own credibility by going after James Craig too aggressively. They haven't been doing that. Whereas on the other hand, the defense has been somewhat aggressive, and I think it's kind of because they have to.
Prosecutors, of course, allege Craig slowly poisoned his wife, Angela, with cyanide and tetrahydrolizine. That's the stuff that's in the eye drops. Both chemicals ordered using aliases and shipped to his office. So it wasn't just as he went down to the Walgreens and said, here, honey, we're going to have a Coke and Visine tonight. It was the actual active chemical that's in there that does it. So if you do it at a higher dose, it's going to be more effective, depending how you're looking at the word effective. Both, again, using aliases and shipped to his office. The poisoning timeline aligns very closely with his online searches and Angela's medical symptoms. So when prosecutors are building a case around poisoning, what extra challenges or advantages do they face in a case like this with, you know, the weird shipments to the office that seem to be the same things that are in her system?
Well, you know, from the prosecution's perspective, thank heavens they got an autopsy because James Craig actually was talking with his daughter about not wanting an autopsy. And now we can, you know, infer why that might be. But the autopsy is so critical in this case because it really details the chemicals that were in her body and how they led to her demise. But still, there are some difficulties because, you know, these things happen behind closed doors. James Craig wasn't introduced poison to her, you know, in front of the other six kids or in front of coworkers or anything like that. The allegation is that he put it into her protein shakes and then on the final fateful day went into the hospital and introduced cyanide into a pill that he somehow got Angela to take. Now, again, there aren't witnesses to that. There's no video to that. And so the jury is going to have to kind of connect the dots, and there are going to be some disconnects throughout that entire factual chain.
And let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, this data is showing a clear timeline, the purchases, the search history, the hospital visits. I mean, is that going to be enough to convince a jury? What sort of holes are you seeing that could be poked into this thing?
So James Craig, depending on who you ask, but it appears he did a reasonably okay job at trying to kind of hide this and cover his own, you know what, because with respect to the poison shipments, he allegedly told his daughter in a letter or verbally that Angela Craig actually wanted the poison but couldn't get it. And so he was the one who went out and got it for her. You know, there are some text messages from Angela Craig in which she appears very distraught based on the infidelity. And so I think defense is going to use that and say, hey, no one can show that James Craig actually introduced this poison into Angela's system. And on top of that, there is at least some evidence that Angela was having a tough time emotionally and mentally. And I think they're going to try to pull all those together to say, hey, jury, that's reasonable doubt as to whether she died by suicide.
I bought my wife the poison because I'm cheating on her. And then it wasn't me. It's like the Shaggy song, literally, like, hanging on the bedroom floor, bought my wife some cyanide last night, then she drank it out the door, now she's in the hospital with a coma for the last 5 days. That was the original, that was the album cut, the radio edit they had.
That was a heck of a remix there.
They had to tone it down for the radio, it was too much. That's quite an argument to make to a jury. I bought her the poison because she was depressed, because I'm a horrible human being and I've been cheating on her left and right. And I just was going to give it to her in case she wanted it. Has that argument ever worked? I mean, maybe so. I don't know, but that's kind of nuts.
That's a novel one to me. and curiously, there is some kind of prior drugging episode that neither side really got into detail regarding, but there are text messages that reference some prior drugging, and it's, according to reports, could have been when James Craig was also suicidal years before, and there was some kind of drugging going on. Although, like I said, we just haven't heard details during the trial about that. So maybe they're going to be able to tie it together in their defense case in chief, which I think is going to be at least a week or so away.
I feel bad for these kids that are realizing just how messed up their parents were. And it's hard because one of them's dead, so we can't really get the full context of what was going on. But if they're both having these problems and they're both contemplating, again, allegedly ending it and getting drugs through the dental practice, this seems like there was a lot of unhealthy things in this relationship. But how do you defend? I mean, is the defense going to be, I got the drugs for her? I would think you go down a road of something of like, I don't know, I needed cyanide. I was trying some new dental damn stuff. something that was going to be applicable to your practice. Not that I'm buying poison for my wife should she like to use it someday.
Certainly that was an idea that was considered, but in court, Tony, James Craig's dental partner, Dr. Ryan Redfern, I think preempted that defense entirely because he got up on the stand and he said, hey, look, in my 20 plus years of being a dentist, arsenic has never been something that has a legitimate purpose in dentistry. Cyanide has never been a chemical with a legitimate dental purpose. And so certainly that could have been an argument raised, but I think James Craig's own dental partner sort of cut that off. I don't think they can argue that.
I don't know how or what dentists have access to ordering. I would imagine, you know, there's some restrictions on what you can and can't order, like, you know, can't just go order like uranium or something for fun. But I guess cyanide and also the chemical in the Visine that they ordered as well, or he ordered as well, allegedly. Why does he even have access to that? Why is that something that he's able to get his hands on in the first place? Or can we?
This part was shocking to me.
If we wanted to order it, we're not dentists, obviously. Could you or I order that stuff online and get it delivered in a legal way, the way he seemingly did?
shockingly, Tony, after one of the Aurora Police Department detectives' testimony last week, it appears the answer is yes.
Oh, God.
So what they did, the detectives looked into the digital footprint. They found an Amazon order for arsenic, and it was for like 10 grams of arsenic, and it was from an account that had Jim and Waffles at Gmail, which is James Craig's personal email address. It had a credit card associated with James Craig. It had an address associated with James Craig, and it appears that he just ordered this stuff on Amazon, and crazily, they sent it to him.
Wow. I wonder if that's a Prime Day deal. Like, gotta get the arsenic. It's a Prime Day special, half off. Get that new Hoover as well. You know, it'll clean up the mess a little bit. The other part of this that I'm curious to get your thoughts on, you know, he shows up to the hospital smiling and calm while she's dying and is, you know, sending the picture to his side chick. Juries are going to see this. Is this something where when you look at James Craig and you said there's kind of almost kind of an aura about him where he maybe feels invincible, at least, you know, that, you know, what one may take off of it. Do you think that these sort of actions, the way he was acting in the hospital, the fact that he ordered this stuff and it's very traceable that he ordered this stuff, was this someone who has kind of a grandiose sense of oneself that no one is going to be the wiser, no matter how many dumb moves I make over here?
That's been my impression so far. And granted, we're still relatively early in the trial. Yeah. I think we still have a few weeks to go. Mm-hmm. But yes, you look at those Amazon orders that most folks would be like, God, I don't want to do this or else I'm going to get caught. And then you combine that with some of his actions in the jail that he did to try and cover this up. And on top of that, in the hospital interaction, Tony, this was something I didn't know until the trial started. He actually went into the hospital room with scrubs on. Now, he's a dentist, and you know, it hasn't come out whether he was doing dental work that day. But the argument for the prosecution is that, hey, he was going in there so he wouldn't be noticed and there would be no one else in there thinking anything was weird while he was allegedly introducing cyanide into Angela Craig's body.
Doing more in the hospital itself.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well, he had the scrubs on in the hospital when he went to meet with Angela when prosecutors say he gave her the final fatal dose of cyanide.
So was anybody in the hospital catching any of this going on? Like, is he like putting it in her IV? Like, how is he administering the cyanide in the hospital?
That's a fair question. And the prosecution hasn't really solidified that yet. I believe in their opening statement, they referenced something about they think it was put into a pill and given to Angela. But, you know, why would Angela be taking a pill from her husband? I guess perhaps he could have concocted some kind of ruse and said, hey, this is going to help you get better and give it to her. But that being said, there were no medical personnel who intervened during that interaction and no like reports of, hey, there's a strange man in scrubs who doesn't work here, who's going into this super sick lady's room.
Is that an insane lack of security more than anything else? I mean, anybody in theory, you know, I mean, unless you got like somebody guarding your door, if it's visiting hours, I guess you could sneak into the bathroom, throw some scrubs on, get the same color everybody else is wearing, and blend in fairly well. People may go, who's that new guy? I don't know. Maybe he's on the third floor and he's just on the wrong floor. I don't know. They got Charleston Chews and the vending machine on this floor, and it's what he came up here for, and to give a cyanide pill to his wife. I don't know. I mean, it just seems, I don't know. Is that a lax area that maybe there should be a little accountability for?
It could be. And, you know, testimony from the medical personnel, there was a doctor on the stand earlier in the trial, multiple nurses, and they kind of said, hey, this was a very busy day, the multiple days that she was in the hospital. Sure. We had a lot of cases. In fact, some of the nurses who testified didn't even have a personal recollection of seeing Angela. They had to reference their notes and then sort of testify based on the notes. So it sounds like there was a lot going on. There are traveling nurses, so new personnel. Folks might not, you know, raise an eyebrow with someone who goes in and scrubs to a hospital room, and they might just think, hey, maybe that's a new guy or a traveling nurse or something else.
Yeah, I mean, if it's just another normal day at the office, because there's a lot of commotion and that's just how it is, you really wouldn't think a whole lot. After his arrest, Craig allegedly wrote a letter to his teenage daughter asking her to create a deep fake video of Angela admitting suicide. Clearly, he's not the most up on how these things are done. It's not that easy. He also is accused of trying to recruit jailhouse witnesses and offering money to take care of a detective. So there's a few things to unpack in this area. How damning is it when the defendant is shown to be orchestrating a cover-up after the alleged crime itself, especially if you're pleading innocent?
You know, if you are factually innocent, if you didn't do anything, it's a tremendous gamble to try and off the lead detective's solicitation of murder. And then on top of that, to recruit your own children to try and fabricate evidence, potentially exposing that kiddo to their own criminal liability. These are some audacious moves from behind the prison bars there in jail. And so very surprising and kind of consistent with this alleged image that James Craig thinks he's untouchable and can kind of get away with whatever.
How did that play out in the courtroom when this was brought up, that he was asking his daughter to go and create deep fake videos, erase your metadata, and using words that he clearly doesn't quite understand how they all apply? You can't just go deep fake mom asking to kill herself. I mean, it would take a little work. And like, I know how to make these sort of things. Even that would be a difficult one to do today, to make it especially stand up to anything. It would be found out to be fake. Is he just that stupid? And also, what happened with the daughter when this request was made?
Yeah. So in terms of the daughter's testimony, first they talked about how the daughter felt about her mom and the mom's future plans. She wanted to be a grandmother. She wanted to move into her forever home sometime soon. All of that's inconsistent with suicide. And the daughters were just saying, you know, how great the mother was. And then they contrasted that with this alleged request by way of a letter from James Craig to his daughter to do the deep fake video, which, yeah, in this day and age, you know, they have digital forensics experts. They can bring in Secret Service folks, high-level professional witnesses who can really pick apart some kind of, you know, deepfake video, look for clues that indicate that it's fake. And so, yeah, I'm not sure how he thought he would get away with this and not be found out. Now, he's going to say that these jailhouse snitches, and one of them was actually a conduit for the letter. Allegedly, James Craig gave it to an inmate who then gave it to the daughter. They're going to say that all of this was made up and these jailhouse snitches are just trying to curry favor to get their own benefit on their own cases.
So that's the excuse. It's all fake. Didn't happen. Not real. I guess that's the easy way of trying to explain it. It just didn't happen. That's not. The daughter, did she testify?
Two daughters testified.
Whose side are they on right now?
So the takeaways from their testimony and sort of just the tone of their testimony really seem to be praising their mother, talking about how great the mother was. She was a mother of six. Mm-hmm. That, you know, this was the thing that she was best at, was being a mother. And so some really heart-wrenching testimony in there from these daughters who appeared to be, you know, in a sense, aligned with their mother. They were called as witnesses for the prosecution. So by that very nature, they're testifying against their father. And there weren't too many points scored by the defense during their testimony. So at the end of the day, I would say that they supported the prosecution and the alleged victim, Angela Craig.
I mean, they could have pleaded the fifth if they wanted to support their father, correct? I mean, that could have been part of the equation. I mean, this really does show us that they probably have accepted maybe who he is. That would be an interesting conversation to have. How old are these kids? Everything I've been reading, they're teenagers. I mean, how old are they that he's making these requests of them?
So there is an order by the judge in the case that prohibits disclosure of the children's names.
Yeah.
However, you know, the children who testified, I believe they were in their early 20s, like 20 okay. and 21 or so.
So they're adults.
So still pretty darn young.
Young, but adults. It's not like a 12-year-old.
Adults, yes.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. I mean, when you have this kind of manipulation going on, I mean, of course you can say, well, it's all a lie. Then the jury's going to have to, you know, wade through that. What about the other accusations that are flying here that he was trying to put a $20,000 hit out on, what was it, the DA? I mean, what, I mean, a $20,000 hit and also trying to influence some witnesses here. How has that played out thus far?
Yeah, so we haven't gotten really to the meat of that just yet. The allegation is that he tried to put a hit on lead detective Bobby Olson. She is a detective with the Aurora Police Department in the Major Crimes Unit. She's at the helm of this case. And so, you know, whenever there is a threat on law enforcement, prosecution takes that so seriously, in part because they work hand in hand with these folks on a day-to-day basis. They develop a rapport. And when you're going after a lead detective, you're kind of going after one of their own. And so the prosecution are certainly taking that extremely seriously in terms of how they're going after James Craig for that solicitation of murder charge.
Like what exactly are they alleging happened here behind bars where he makes this request out there with the offer of 20 grand?
My understanding is that he made several requests behind bars. One of the requests was to an inmate to try to arrange for lead detective Bobby Olson to be killed. We haven't heard really the finite details of that just yet. I think they're going to get into that this week. But in addition to that, he approached some inmates who were there in jail for fraud and for kind of a forgery ring. And he wanted them to try to drum up and fabricate some kind of evidence to show that Angela Craig was suicidal, that he was then going to combine with this deepfake video he wanted his daughter to make.
Has he completely just lost his mind at this point? I mean, this is just so grandiose. I mean, like, no one's going to raise a red flag. Oh, the lead detective dead. I wonder if it's connected to any of the cases this lead detective might be a part of. Hey, maybe this guy over here who has a history of trying to kill people. So, is this going to be another thing that the defense is going to argue? It's fake. It's made up. Somebody is doing this to garner favor with something. And this is something he just didn't do.
I believe so. At least one of the requests that James Craig allegedly made of an inmate was just verbal. So there's no, they don't have like a letter. They don't have texts or emails or something like that. They're just saying that there was a verbal exchange inside the jail. And what the defense is going to say is that, hey, you can't believe these inmates. They knew this was a high profile case. And what they did was they made some stuff up because they thought it might help their own cases, might mitigate their own sentences. That's the horse defense is going to ride on many of these activities inside the jail that James Craig allegedly perpetrated.
And is that really that crazy of a response? I mean, inmates will make things up to get whatever advantage they can have. And if you don't have it on paper, which even when they have it on paper, half the time is up for debate. Like, that doesn't look like it's his, right? It's verbal. Okay. Sounds pretty horrible, but don't they need to something a little stronger than that if it's going to stick?
It would certainly be helpful to have that. I think the way the prosecution is going to handle it is to say, hey, there are all these measures he took within the jail, some of which does have documentation, like letters, like requesting his daughter do the deepfake. And so it's not really a logical leap to say, oh, and he also took these other consistent, very similar measures, all with an objective to cover up this murder of his wife. I think that's the way the prosecution's going to play it, even though they don't have, you know, some smoking gun of a text message saying, hey, go kill the lead detective. They're going to bring it all together and say, hey, you know, if he did X, he probably did Y. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if you're capable of doing this, you're certainly capable of doing that. And I would say in a lot of cases, that's a very true statement, but that's not how we decide guilt and innocence in our country. At least we're not supposed to, sure. But sometimes we do. every trial has a rhythm. It starts with a slow burn of discovery, the evidence, the prep, the positioning, all of it. The prosecution is now threading together motive, financial strain, the affair, the image control, the means, the poisoning, the post-crime consciousness of guilt. The defense is leaning on the lack of eyewitnesses here, the alternative explanations, the personal, emotional complexity. How tight does a prosecution case need to be when, I mean, this is largely circumstantial? Is the digital evidence going to be enough, in your opinion, here in a case like this? We've seen a lot of interesting outcomes lately where, of course, all it takes is one. But one, I don't know, feels like it's coming by a lot easier than it used to.
You know, this is such a tough case for the defense because, like I said, there's the digital footprint, there's the toxicology report, there are actions taken allegedly with a consciousness of guilt to cover it up. And you know, if Angela Craig had died some other way, defense would have more outs here. But really, even though they don't have any burden, they don't legally need to do this, the jury's going to want to say, hey, what is the plausible alternative explanation as to how Angela Craig died of poisoning? And someone slowly administering poison to themselves over the course of weeks, suffering and suffering and suffering, is just not terribly plausible.
Yeah, I mean, what is... what's your best route here? I mean, as a defense attorney, what's your best route to introduce a reasonable doubt? Is it just that there's all these other maybe possibilities out there? None of them are super strong, but just, you know, you go at them in mass with a lot of things. Just scatter all this out there under the thing and maybe you'll be distracted. I don't know. I don't know where you'd go on this one.
You know, that's really been the defense's approach. And I know Lisa Moses. She is the lead defense attorney, and she is very good. And she is on top of things. And she's scoring some points where she can. For example, when they were talking about the internet searches from a Google account, like how many grams of cyanide will kill a person and terribly incriminating searches like that, the defense did establish that, hey, it was the detectives who just went through the computer to find those searches. It wasn't a digital forensics expert, and the detectives did it in kind of a casual fashion that could give rise to some mistakes. Perhaps defense is going to argue that they planted some of these searches to kind of put their finger on the scale at the end of the day.
And that's why everything needs to be done correctly. Otherwise, get situations like this where maybe this happened, maybe this didn't happen. Obviously, you know, there's a big emotional narrative to this whole thing. The prosecution has created that emotional narrative. Craig wanted to escape the crumbling life and he wanted out this way, so he decided to kill his wife. But again, it's a tough one when you got six kids. I mean, that is a hard pill to swallow, that dad would want to end life of mom that badly that he's going to go to that level. But obviously, he had financial troubles. That's documented. He had a mistress. That's documented. He had failing business partnerships. That's documented. How do you separate the bad character from the criminal intent and make that clear to a jury?
Oh, sure. So, and you know, the defense did, I thought, a reasonably good job when they were talking about text messages. So what they were showing was that James Craig appeared to be trying to repair the relationship after the infidelity, saying how much he loves Angela Craig. He wants them to have a future. He wants her to be his wife going forward. And, you know, arguably, all of that is inconsistent with wanting to kill her. And so I think that defense is trying to show the good side that they have of James Craig while all of this other kind of monstrous evidence is coming out.
Are we going to see any other elements of character in this, of him acting nefarious? Obviously, we do have some after the fact in prison. But again, I could see that being spun of either it's just BS, it didn't happen, and they're trying to railroad him. Or he's doing it because this is his only way out, because everyone's going to think he's guilty no matter what. So he has to do something to create this ruse that will bring you to the reality of what life actually is and not what they want you to believe. I could see that being the thing. But the thing is, beforehand, prior to all of this happening, Do we have anything? Do we have any evidence of a character pattern of him being deceptive to others in life? I know there were some business issues that were going on. I don't think, obviously, a lot of those are getting into this trial. But a pattern of behavior that shows anything that would point to this guy being capable of killing his wife.
Well, you know, some interesting pieces of evidence have come out that relate to character already. So one thing that came out in court that I was unaware of before this trial, and it was kind of a dramatic moment, the office manager testified. And what she testified to was that she developed an intimate emotional relationship with James Craig. That's how they put it. So you add that to his documented and admitted infidelity in December of 2022, 3 months before Angela Craig died. And then apparently there was infidelity going on for quite some time before that. And I think defense is going to argue that, hey, if some kind of new mistress wanted or caused James Craig to kill somebody, to kill his wife, that would have happened years ago because he had multiple mistresses before that. And so they're trying to kind of turn that negative into a positive and spin it in a way that helps protect James Craig.
Yeah, I mean, is it showing that he's, you know, a manipulator and, you know, a womanizer, or, you know, I'm sure that's probably how they'll want to spin it, but, or is it showing that he's, you know, capable of something much darker? Because you're right, like, if he wanted out before and he seems to be going and living this life, why now would suddenly murder be the way out of it? Unless we're looking at financial difficulties or some sort of reason to get out of this, is that going to be part of the motive here in some way, shape, or form as well? Is there a financial angle to this?
The prosecution has tried to tie that in. So what they've established is that James Craig was having serious business issues. He had a prior bankruptcy, I believe in 2020, so around three years before Angela Craig died. He was trying to get back on his feet business-wise. He partnered with this Dr. Redfern, but it wasn't going that well. And Redfern testified that even out of the 10 months they were partnered, they only had a profit like 2 months or so. And so they're kind of just making the argument that James Craig's life was crashing in all around him from multiple angles, romantic, professional, all of that. And that sort of pushed him over the edge to ultimately poison his wife and start anew.
Is there something else going on with this guy? I mean, it just feels, I mean, just his line of thinking is so out there. It seems in so many ways, it makes you wonder, like, is there some mental health problem going on to think, you know, you're going to get the deep fake video made, you're going to get a hit out on the detective? I mean, none of this seems to be like the reasoning or the thinking of a healthy brain that's also capable of working in dentistry and reaching the levels that he did at one point. It makes you, I mean, my mind, when I first heard about this case all those years ago, was like, is he really into drugs or something? Because this seems really off, or some sort of a psychological break. Is there any area where they're looking at the psychology of this case or his psychology to go, he's sick, there's something off here?
You know, it wouldn't surprise me if his attorneys, you know, months before trial, had a mental health evaluation done for the reasons you mentioned. Although I don't know that was performed, and we certainly haven't heard any evidence of it at trial. It's debatable whether it would even be admissible at trial.
Sure.
But yeah, you would think that you'd want to look into sort of the psyche of this person. One thing I would note too, Tony, is that one of his prior attorneys, Harvey Steinberg, for whom I worked, he's an esteemed defense attorney, he filed a motion to withdraw on a previously scheduled first day of trial, saying that the course of action the client wanted to proceed in was either fraudulent or criminal, and that it was either repugnant to the attorney or something with which the attorney fundamentally disagreed. And so read into that what you will.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you'd really have to read it, because I know he can't say exactly what it was. Can he say that later? Like, once this thing is done, can he share what on earth that was?
Probably not, though. James Craig is alive. There's still a privilege, though he withdrew.
So
you can't necessarily disclose the basis for that.
Obviously, you can't disclose that. But I mean, if you were to, I mean, can you speculate? Like, what kind of thing would have to be said? I mean, just in theory here, to make the attorney right up there, right before the trial is supposed to start, saying, I'm out.
It could be any number of things, you know, just kind of speculating at this point. But one possible theoretical basis could be that James Craig wanted to strenuously argue to this jury that Angela Craig killed herself. And perhaps the attorney just wasn't on board with that. He didn't think that there was significant evidence of that. And you can't go into a jury trial and just tell a bald-faced lie or something you think is a bald-faced lie to a jury. And so I'm wondering if that possibly played a role. And I'm wondering if James Craig wanted the attorney to somehow engage in a course of action that either or perhaps distance James Craig from the jailhouse activities when the attorney didn't see like there was any truth to doing that.
Yeah. Seems like a manipulator, to say the least. We'll see what happens here as you continue to sit in on that trial. Always a pleasure and always exciting to hear your side of this. Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor, thank you so much for your insight into the world of James Craig today.
Good to be with you.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.